You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 1st of May 2024 on Monocle Radio. It's 1900 in Hong Kong, 1400 in Kishinev, midday here in London, and 7 a.m. in New York City. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme...
Why are you in riot gear? There is no riot here. Free, free Palestine.
If you refuse to disperse, you will be placed under arrest and charged with disorderly conduct. This is the New York City Police Department. You are unlawfully obstructing pedestrian traffic.
Violence breaks out at US university campuses as protesters clash and police move in. Then, Donald Trump finally pays a price for his social media posts.
Get ready to write your own story.
We'll get the latest from Broadway as the Tony nominations are announced, with a musical based on the life of Alicia Keys leading the pack. Plus, why Russian election meddling has landed a Moldovan governor in court, and the latest business news too. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. Well, after weeks of protests at American university campuses, overnight things have escalated, with police taking action to remove students from an occupied building at Columbia University in New York City, whilst in Los Angeles, rival pro-Israel and pro-Palestine protesters have clashed with each other, as well as police called in by the university. Reporter Karina Choi witnessed events in New York overnight and joins us now. Karina, can you take us through what happened?
So things on Columbia's campus escalated really quickly last night after nearly 2 weeks of protests, when hundreds of police in riot gear arrived late in the evening to clear out the university's encampment and arrest several dozen students in and around Hamilton Hall, a building that was broken into earlier this week and occupied by some protesters. And what's particularly symbolic is that the same building was also violently cleared out by the NYPD 56 years ago to the date after a similar student occupation during the anti-Vietnam War protests. Now, the students arrested are most likely expelled from Columbia at this point and face charges including burglary to third degree, criminal mischief, and also trespassing. And now last night's order was given by the university's president, Manoush Shafiq, who said that her decision was informed by a, quote, clear and present danger to the substantial functioning of the university. Shafiq has also ordered the police to remain on campus until May 17th, which is around the time of the university's commencement. So tensions are still high even after last night's arrests.
And just the sort of removal last night of the students, I mean, how peaceful was it? Was there a lot of resistance by students? Did it get violent at all?
So from what I've seen based on reports from inside campus, and just to be clear, not a lot of press were allowed inside campus. So most of this reporting are coming from student journalists. There were some scenes of violence. One protester was dragged out by three police officers. And then otherwise, the police were sort of disrupting barricades that were built by protesters. But on the outside, things were generally peaceful. Protesters didn't really push back when police tried to, disperse them. They continue to form human chains and just, you know, approach police very peacefully. From speaking to some of the protesters outside who eventually, went back to their dorms, they say that they're very disappointed with how the university has handled the whole situation, you know, which began as a peaceful encampment. They also expressed disappointment in the president's decision to keep police on campus, which they say is just doesn't make school life feel any safer.
And in terms of what happens next, I mean, you've mentioned there that the students that were arrested are likely to be expelled. Are they able to appeal that at all? And how many students are we sort of talking about here?
So what the NYPD said is that roughly 25 students at Columbia have been arrested. We're not clear on that number this morning, but what happens to them really depends on, the legal assistance that they receive and negotiations with the school. But basically, what happens next, that's still also very unclear. Columbia has made it clear that it will not divest from Israel, which is the protesters' main demand, but will make more investments into health and education in Gaza and open up more discussions and on what it means to have free speech on campus. But this has been denounced as too little by protesters, and which is essentially why they escalated their tactics yesterday. Otherwise, I think one thing that people on both sides of this debate are clear about is that they want the university's president, Manoush Shafiq, to resign because of her handling of the situation, with many saying that, her actions have contributed to an unsafe environment for students, citing the rise of anti-Semitism, while others saying that, she's played a huge role in suppressing free speech over the past few weeks.
And why do you think US university campuses, and we've seen similar scenes across the night, and particularly a sort of fighting actually at UCLA between the different camps and the police there going in, why do you think this movement has really gripped US universities?
I think, this whole situation started as the whole, protest movement began as students calling for divestment from U.S. universities, many of which have deep ties to Israel. So divestment is actually really tough, but it's also turned into an issue of free speech at college campuses, which some may argue is distracting for those really pushing for the original cause. There are now over 100 similar types of pro-Palestinian protests across the country and all over the world, as far as Japan. But I think these movements are still going strong because students feel like they have the negotiating power. This is what, liberal institutions in the US have advocated for, freedom of expression and dissent. What's been a notable development in this whole story, though, is that yesterday, Brown University, another Ivy League in Providence, has managed to negotiate terms with student protesters so that they would clear their encampment in exchange for the corporate board's vote on the university's divestment from Israel. And so, while this does not guarantee divestment will actually happen, it's a significant step and, shows what universities could potentially do and sets kind of a good example, I guess, for those who are championing the pro-Palestinian cause. But observers have noted that this type of negotiation was much more peaceful and meaningful than what has happened at Columbia. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens on other college
Because there
campuses.
has been different tactics employed. Just finally, I know you covered the Hong Kong protests a few years ago, and they have taken some lessons from that. The sort of mantra of brutally be like water, that's been a bit of a strategy used.
Yes, looking on Hong Kong Twitter, there have been a lot of academics and observers who've compared, the US college protests to the Hong Kong protests, the sort of tactics of be water, appearing in one place and then dispersing and then appearing in another place and having open communication lines between groups. I must say, though, based on what I saw last night, the police presence at Columbia was absolutely disproportionate. There were hundreds of police, arriving on campus to arrest several dozen students. It really stoked fears for a lot of people, a lot of people who live in the surrounding community. And I must say that I didn't see that type of police presence, or as many police, as I did, in Hong Kong, sorry, compared to Hong Kong, which, arguably, the protests there in 2019 drew thousands, if not millions, of protesters at the height of the movement.
Karina, thank you. That was Karina Choi. Now here's Paige Reynolds with today's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. The United Nations has warned that an Israeli assault on Rafah in the Gaza Strip is on the immediate horizon, and that incremental progress on aid access to the enclave cannot be used by Israel to justify an operation. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres appealed for states with influence over Israel to do everything in their power to prevent an Israeli assault on the city that is currently sheltering 1.2 million displaced Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. Chinese state media has reported today that China has launched sea trials for the Fujian, its third and most advanced aircraft carrier. The development of the Fujian is part of a build-up central to President Xi Jinping's bid to make China the preeminent military power in the region, with a blue water navy capable of projecting power far from China's coast. And Vietnam's parliament is set to meet tomorrow to discuss personnel issues. This comes 5 days after the chairman of the country's lawmaking body quit for personal reasons, and a month after the resignation of the country's president, Vo Van Thong. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thanks, Paige. And now for a look at the latest business news headlines with the head of investment at Interactive Investor, Victoria Scholar. Victoria, welcome back to the programme. We're starting off with some results from Amazon.
Yes, so we had earnings from Amazon out yesterday, and it reported first quarter earnings which beat expectations thanks to strong demand for cloud computing on the back of the boom in artificial intelligence, and its operating margin surpassed 10% for the first time ever. We also saw that sales jumped 13% to $143.3 billion, and net income also more than tripled. But for the current quarter, its guidance for revenue fell a bit short of expectations, and the company said that capital spending on generative AI would increase throughout the year, which might make investors a bit nervous.
And the Fed has been meeting to discuss interest rates.
Yes, that's right. It will be concluding at the end of its policy meeting tonight, deciding on whether to change interest rates. But it's almost certain that the central bank is going to keep rates on hold at 5.25% to 5.5% for the sixth decision in a row. But markets are going to be much more focused instead on clues from the Fed into when the central bank might finally begin cutting rates. We've seen that the latest data on inflation shows that price pressures are still high. The latest reading hit 3.5% in the year to March, which was above expectations. And it's this stickier than expected inflation, which is why the Fed has been having to keep interest rates at this 23-year high since last July.
Well, speaking of rates and record high mortgage rates for many people, house prices in the UK not as high as expected.
Yes, that's right. So we saw that, according to Nationwide, a mortgage lender, British house prices dropped for the second consecutive month in April. House prices fell by 0.4% despite analysts' expectations for growth, and it follows a similar drop in March. And Nationwide said that the slowdown reflects ongoing affordability pressures with long-term interest rate rises hitting people's ability to repay their loans. And this has been... We've seen that long-term interest rates have actually been rising more recently, and that follows a steep fall that we saw at the turn of the year. And so house prices are now about 4% below their all-time highs.
Victoria Scholar, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Donald Trump has used social media to attack critics, fire staff, provoke foreign leaders, and even sound off on Kristen Stewart breaking up with Robert Pattinson back in the day. But finally, he's having to pay for his posts, with the judge in his New York City porn star hush money case fining the former president $9,000, which because he violated a gag order that had been imposed. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Scott Lucas, adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College Dublin. Scott, thank you for joining us. What exactly did Donald Trump say in these posts?
He did what Donald Trump normally does, which is he blasted people including those involved in the trial, the judge, the prosecution, the judge's clerk, the judge's family, and said that they were all out to get him. He said, in other words, this is a witch hunt. This is a plot, which, of course, is linked to the Democrats and linked to the 2024 presidential election. He was warned repeatedly by Judge Juan Merchan, who's overseeing the trial, to desist. He wouldn't do so, even after the trial began. And the prosecution simply gave Merchan a list of the initial 10 infractions on social media, and Merchan upheld 9 of them. And by the way, this isn't the end of the matter, because after those 10 instances were cited, Trump went back on social media, and there are 4 more cases that the judge will be considering soon.
And I mean, he is under threat now of facing jail for breaching this gag order, isn't he?
What Merchan said yesterday is yes, you have been fined $9,000, effectively $1,000 for each of the offending posts. If you repeat this, if you continue, then you know the next step from this is to serve prison time. Merchant's being quite reluctant, I think, so far to do so. I think it would cause, to say the least, explosive headlines if you had a prison sentence imposed in the middle of Trump's first criminal trial, which is why Trump will continue to test the limits. He went on to social media yesterday and again denounced this rigged trial. He was careful not to target any particular individual in those posts, so he may skate by with this. But I think you've got a game of chicken going on, which is because Trump cannot speak out in court unless he testifies in his own defense. Because he can't speak out in court, he's getting increasingly frustrated, and this is his attempt to hit back.
And how hard a time is his legal team having trying to contain him, or are they just not bothering?
Well, he's got different members of the legal team. So, you've got the lead attorney, who's Todd Blanche, who's the one interacting with Merchan most of the time. He's the one that has been, I think, trying to undermine the prospective witnesses, notably the porn star Stormy Daniels, with whom Trump had a sexual encounter, and Trump's former fixer and lawyer, Michael Cohen. The other lawyers, like Susan Nechelis, who's been brought in to provide expert advice, they occasionally will, have words with Trump, but they're mainly trying to keep a lower profile. They know they've got a tough case to defend. They don't want to upset Merchan any more than Trump is doing by appearing to be too provocative.
And are the juries sort of made aware at all that Trump is making these posts and getting fined, or are they being kept in the dark about this?
No, this is being kept separate from the actual trial that takes place. So when you had the hearings earlier this week about, the prosecution's presentation of the social media post, the arguments between prosecution and defense over this, and Merchan's deliberations, you kept that separate from, you sealed it off from the jury, because you don't want this to be prejudicial on the facts of the trial. Even though it doesn't put Trump in a good light, it is not germane to the immediate, 34 felony charges over the falsification of business records over that affair with Stormy Daniels.
And Trump has 3 other looming trials. Are the judges there watching and considering perhaps whether or not they should impose a similar gag order to protect their own families, their own staff in the court?
Well, Trump has already been warned in other court cases, both in the civil cases and also in the impending criminal cases, this is an acceptable behavior. I think this will simply just reinforce the necessity of maintaining those gag orders once we get to those other trials. But right now, because of the delaying tactics of the Trump people and because of complications, in particular in the Georgia case over election interference and pending the Supreme Court's ruling on whether Trump is immune from any criminal charges in this amazing claim that he's made to the highest court in the land, I think the gag orders there are not going to be the primary issue we face in the coming weeks in those other trials, even while they are center to the current one.
And just finally, on that Supreme Court case, where is that at now, and how soon will we be hearing back from the justices?
We've had the arguments which have been made before the court by both sides. The judges have asked questions. People have tried to interpret which way the justices must go, but we simply have to wait now. Decision probably, you know, expected later this spring, definitely before the court recesses in July. But what it means is that even if Trump, I think, doesn't win the case, that he has this absolute immunity, it does push back, I think, the most important trial, which is the federal trial over his attempt to overturn the 2020 election, pushes the start of that back to at least September.
Scott Lucas, thank you. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Well, to Moldova now, where yesterday the trial began of a Kremlin-allied governor accused of channeling funds from Russia to a now-banned pro-Moscow party. Evgenia Gutil was emerged from obscurity last year to win local elections. She is a Putin fan and opposes Moldova's pro-European government that accuses the Kremlin of political meddling. To help unpack this, I'm joined by the journalist Alina Radu, who manages the Guard newspaper, Moldova's largest investigative media organisation. Alina, welcome to the programme. Could you start by giving us an overview of who Evgenia is?
Hello, and nice to meet you and to hear about you. Evgenia Gutul is leading a part of Moldova. This is named Gagauzia. This is a region, and she was like elected there last year. But we have to understand that she is mainly supported by Russia, and the elections went into a very obscure manner, and there were so many cases of people who are intoxicated informationally. They have lack of information about what happens in Moldova. Most of the information gets there is about what Putin does, what Russia does, why people should stay with Russia. And most of the information there is spread in Russian, and people speak mostly Russian. Beside the fact that Gagauzian people, the original people in that region, have to speak Gagauzian language because this is their mother language. It is a kind of Turkish language. But the tradition comes from the Soviet Union when Moscow decided to kill all the languages, and so everybody would speak Russian. So it happened to all of us. Our main language is Romanian, but we had to speak Russian. So people from that region couldn't learn, study Gagauzian, their own language. They had to speak Russian, so they lost in a way
and
their language.
Evgenia, now she is on trial. I mean, what's she exactly accused of doing on behalf of Moscow?
She's accused of using dirty money from Moscow into her campaign to buy votes, to buy voters, and to become a leader of the region. And there were many cases of people from that region coming from Moscow with loads of money and spending them in political campaigns and in elections. So there are many proofs about that. But unfortunately, the first sitting that had place didn't last too much because Evgenia came and said she doesn't understand anything because all the materials are in Moldovan state language, which is Romanian, and she said she doesn't understand anything, so all the materials should be translated into Russian for her. So the court had to take now a bit of time to translate all the materials for this person.
Well, once they've done that, I mean, what's the likelihood she'll be convicted?
This is a problem. If you look at the money she spent and the proof, everybody thinks and the law says she might be convicted from 2 to 7 years in jail. But Moldovan justice is still corrupt because we had an oligarch regime who was controlling judicial system in Moldova. So it is actually about corruption, not about justice now. I hope there will be correct judges who will judge that, and then it is clear that she'll be convicted. But Moscow spends money not only with Evgenia Gutsul, Moscow spends money also in corrupting some judges, lawyers, politicians, and we are not sure now about the Moldovan judicial system. Mm.
And finally, just stepping back now, this party that she was funding, the pro-Russian party, the Shore Party, has been banned. But how is Moldova doing in fending off Russia's influence, something that many sort of former Soviet republics in Europe are struggling with?
I think Russia is making a test of with Moldova in this case, and then they will use the same way with many other countries. I mean, Moldova seems to be a small country, not important, but they manage here to buy politicians, to create parties. If the party is prohibited by the law, they create other party. Is sure are under European sanctions, they manage to cooperate another way. So Russia is doing a war against European agenda of Republic of Moldova, and they repeat every day that Moldova has not to join European Union and not to go to Europe. So this is a very serious fight now between some pro-European politicians and political parties and leaders, and between these hidden pro-Russian forces, because Evgenia Gutsul and a couple of other politicians are openly saying about that and are flying to Moscow every month and are coming back from there, offering to people some promises that are not real, but, you know, look attractive. Mm.
And Alina Radu in Chișinău, thank you very much. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, yesterday, the 2024 Tony nominations were announced in New York, with Stereophonic and Hell's Kitchen both scoring 13 nominations. The awards will take place next month, and to discuss the field, I'm joined now in the studio by Matt Wolfe, theatre critic at the International New York Times. Matt, thanks for coming into the studio. What caught your eye yesterday?
Well, first of all, we have to point out how important these are commercially. I mean, in London, we have the Olivier Awards, and it's nice to win them, but it actually doesn't really matter a whole lot at the box office. In New York, the Tonys are crucial. And one of the reasons that there's this kind of end-of-season crunch of openings, and there were 12 shows opening in 9 days, is to kind of catch everyone's eye. Like at the Oscars, you open all the big movies at the end of the year. So, yes, as you mentioned, Hell's Kitchen and Stereophonic are both leading the pack. Stereophonic of the two, that's a play. Hell's Kitchen is a musical. Stereophonic is astonishing in that it managed to get 13 Tony nominations, including nominations for 5 members of its 7-person cast. And it's a play, but it was nominated for Best Score because it's a play with music. And so it's competing in categories that plays don't normally compete in. It also has no stars in it. It's a real ensemble. So the success of it, I think, is quite unique.
And what's it about? Sorry, for anyone that doesn't
know. Well, I haven't seen it yet, so I will know. But I can. It's about a Fleetwood Mac-type group in the 70s putting together an album. So you're in the recording
studio. So it's their
rumors,
basically.
Yeah, okay. Exactly right. Exactly. And I gather you're in the studio, you're following all the personal pressures, the sort of commercial pressures. And it began off-Broadway, as most plays begin elsewhere. Very few plays begin on Broadway. And if this does take the Tony for Best Play on June 16th, this seems to be the case, it will really send out a signal to American playwrights that actually there is a chance of hitting it big. You don't have to have a big star. Of course, it helps if you do, but you don't have to. The musicals front is very odd. some of the more highly acclaimed musicals of the season had already closed by the time the Tony nominations came around, like Days of Wine and Roses, Here Lies Love, the David Byrne musical. So the field was dominated pretty much entirely by the shows that are still running, a lot of which didn't get great reviews. Hell's Kitchen is the now putative frontrunner. That's a jukebox musical, which I have seen off-Broadway, that tells the story of Alicia Keys. Mm-hmm. And it's basically her story. What's interesting is that when it was off-Broadway, it was happening way downtown. Now, Uptown, it actually is right next to the area in the title. Hell's Kitchen is Midtown Manhattan. That's where the show now is playing. So you can exit the theater and find yourself in the locale where it's set. I am a big Sondheimian, as people will probably know, the composer lyricist Stephen Sondheim, who passed away a couple years ago. Great interest in the incredible reclamation of a show of his called Merrily We Roll Along that got 9 nominations, having been a huge flop 23 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, you know, any sort of sleeper hits that might, you know, be a surprise on the night, who is it?
Well, I think Appropriate, which is a show that a production that has been seen before but is now on Broadway, a high-profile production with Sarah Paulson, a well-known actress who's really hit the big time. And she is going up for Best Actress against Jessica Lange in her mid-70s, back on Broadway in a new play called Mother Play, the first new play that Jessica Lange has ever done on Broadway. All the rest have been classics. So it's a very, very kind of rich array. It should be said the Brits didn't do all that well. There was a Peter Morgan play called Patriots. Mm-hmm. About Abramovich and Russian oligarchs.
I saw that in London last year.
And Vladimir Putin with Will Keane.
Tom Hollander was
Tom Hollander, that's right, playing Barzovsky. He's the one person not in it in New York. And it got 1 Tony nomination. And at a time when the nominations are crucial, I'm sorry to say I think that bodes ill for the success of the play in New York. Cabaret, the much vaunted production directed by Rebecca Fretman.
Eddie Redmayne taking
here.
The MC role again.
Eddie Redmayne was nominated again in New York. Weirdly, Rebecca Fretman, whose vision the entire production is, was not nominated in New York. And I think there seems to be a bit of a pushback against perhaps Brits coming in and telling Americans how to do their shows.
Okay. Interesting.
A little
interesting.
Bit
interesting. All right. Well, Matt Wolff, thank you very much for that. And that's all we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. You can find past episodes of the show and all our others on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. And do drop us an email as well about anything you've heard. My email is vm@monocle.com. I'm Vincent McAvinny, goodbye, and thank you for listening.